Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I get to welcome to the show Don Rehm. Now, he is here to discuss the science behind engaged employees, guaranteed solutions for increasing staff retention and performance. Now, Don is a nationally recognized TEDx speaker. He's an author, a CEO, and as a former White House correspondent and science advisor to Congress, he's a broadcast reporter and Washington, D.C. bureau chief. Don brings a very unique science-based approach to his thought leadership on workplace engagement. And boy, do we need it, especially and, you know, we're working with a lot of different age groups in the workplace now, and it can cause, you know, their own little problems. We hear about it all the time. I think he can help us. So today we're going to talk about how science has revealed more about the brain in the last 5 years than in the previous 1,000. How should these new findings change our current management techniques and enhance our human relations and business? He's going to share practical insights to increase employee engagement based on empirically validated theory of human behavior. He's going to share with us how to distinguish employee engagement from employee satisfaction. There is a big difference, by the way, and how to apply that knowledge in organizations to improve staff performance and decrease turnover. And finally, if we have time, and I hope we do, he's going to show us how to take immediate steps to improve any workplace culture, regardless of industry, hype, or employee title. And I'll be very frank with you. I'm going to be very quiet because he has a lot to share. So I'm going to let him run with it. I will jump in and ask questions as they occur. But this is such an important topic. I really want him to just share. So good morning, Don. No pressure, right, Don? Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. No pressure.
Well,
so is there
thank you.
Anything I missed in that bio? Anything important that you need our audience to know?
No. No. That was wonderful. Probably too much. The key thing is the background in the sciences, and that was the key to when I started this company. It was to bring more science into the field of leadership and HR and human resources, because there's very little science in it right now. And one of the challenges we face as leaders, and I'm sure your listeners feel the same challenge, is there are all these books in leadership out there. There's more than 1,000 books on leadership in print today, and yet very few of them are based on science. There's many of them have data, but they don't have real science. That is an underlying scientific understanding of what drives behavior, so that why the tactics and things they talk about work or don't work. And that's a challenge. And the other challenge with all this leadership literature, we've had at least 2.5 decades of being immersed in leadership book and theory made up by the authors after another. And yet the number of employees reporting being engaged when they get to work has barely budged in that time. So what that says is these leadership books are good reads, and they're great people and they're powerful stories, but they're being read by individuals who are then having a really challenging time implementing that systemically inside the organization. And this is also one of the challenges of sending people off to leadership training camps, is they get very excited, very motivated, but then they come back into the same environment they left, and no one else is doing those things. And so it quickly dissipates and doesn't have much of an impact. So what we wanted to do was, instead of this traditional top-down look of leaders writing about why they think they were great leaders, we start instead with the research around human behavior and what motivates human behavior. Why do we do what we do every day? And the fascinating thing for me, and the opportunity to set up a company around these scientific developments is that not only do we share 99.9% of our DNA with each other, we also share a common operating system. That is what motivates us to do what we do. And all we had to do was to translate that understanding into the workplace.
How in the world did you come to this? I mean, it's a lofty goal. It really is. But I think there's a bit of a story behind your journey to get to this point where you understood that it is scientifically based, that there are some things that you can do. You're right. Look, I've read all the leadership books, the motivational books. I love them. We all do, right? That's why there's so many of them out there. Putting them into play is tough. It really is. You know, you think, okay, I got this. Ooh, I don't got this. I mean, you really don't.
So how did you arrive at this?
I'm curious.
Well, I've been working with organizations for 30 years, primarily in the area of how to communicate with more clarity. And I finally reached the point where I realized that helping them communicate clearly is great, but if they're not communicating things that actually make a difference, what's the point? And I didn't want to be in the smoke. I wanted to be in the fire. And so it took me into this research around culture and company culture and what drives it, and then combined with this new science. And there are two key parts of the scientific literature that we rely on, and they're compatible. One is called social baseline theory, developed by a brilliant clinical psychologist and neuroscientist at University of Virginia in Charlottesville named James Cone, Dr. James Cone, C-O-A-N. And the other is a theory that's been around for over eight decades. It was discovered in World War II. It's called adult attachment. And so social baseline theory, Dr. Cone, what he's been able to demonstrate in his labs and others have as well, fundamentally, human beings are herd animals. We're hardwired to be in a group. And that might seem obvious to some, and that makes sense, and that's true. We do like to be, we're social animals, in effect. But what people often don't understand is when you take that to its fullest extension in terms of brain capacity and people performing at their best, it turns out that we will only perform close to our full capacity if we can do so with others. Trusted others would be the common term. We are not designed as a species to work in isolation, in spite of all the Western notions about, you know, being independent. And Simon and Garfunkel had this song, and one of the lyrics was, "I am a rock, I am an island."
I'm a rock.
I think they were being sarcastic. If not, it was delusional, because we're not rocks and we're not islands. We are hardwired at birth to have safe and secure connections with other people. And as Dr. Cone said, and I quote in the beginning of chapter 2 in my book where I talk about this, he said, the dominant ecology of the human being is other human beings. And so it didn't take long then to think, well, okay, so we're hardwired to be in a tribe, but we don't grow up in tribes anymore. But where do we spend most of our time when we're awake with other adults? And the answer is, of course, at work. Work is quite literally the new tribe for the 21st century Homo sapien. It is where we go and gather with other adults. It is where we spend most of our time while awake. And so what is it about this workplace tribe that we're hardwired to be a part of, and yet it just seems so dysfunctional for most employees when they get there? Again, 70% of employees report being disengaged when they're at work. One in five in a new report just out the last month or so report being in an overtly toxic environment when they're at work. And how did we get this so wrong? We've got part of the equation right. We're gathering people together. But it's that second part of the equation. What should that environment be like? And what are the constituents, the components of that tribal experience that's missing in the workplace? And that's what we've identified.
And see, Don, it never occurred to me, even though now that you've explained it, it should be so glaringly obvious that the workplace is our tribe. Now, I work alone. You know, I live and breathe and work in my home by design. I'm an introvert, and I don't play well with others. So this works very well with me. However, having said that, I am in constant contact with people all day long. all day long. And they're people that I choose to be in contact with, their clients,
yes.
They're my team members. And it's a pretty nifty existence, but I created that. But people who are in a workplace don't have that option many times, do they?
No, they don't. And you've identified an interesting reality of the workplace. You can be at home, working at home, and not feel alone, or that is isolated. But you could be at work surrounded by people and also feel isolated and alone.
Right.
So it's not the simple act of being in the presence of others. Actually, for the brain, being in a room full of strangers, for example, is metabolically exhausting. It's not reassuring, and it isn't comfortable. But being in a room with people that have your back, that are predictable and consistent, that works. Now, for you, yes, you work at home alone, and a lot of Americans do now. But it's really important that you don't feel isolated. And so we create our communities, and your community may be the wonderful community you live in. It can also be, as you mentioned, your teammates that you work with, and you're communicating with them during the day. My company, E3 Solutions, we're also a dispersed company. But we are all chatting all day long on a software platform called Slack, where we can have constant conversations with individuals, with teams working on a certain project. So we can use technology to try to overcome this a little bit. But there is actually no substitute for face-to-face interaction with people.
Really? Truly like to be all by myself. Solitude is my natural bent. It's where I've lived my best life. And I love what you
said about
being in a room or a group of, you know, strangers is metabolically difficult. I never identified it as that, but you're right. I mean, I am wretched when I'm in a crowd, and I've got my keys out 59 three-quarter minutes. I'm gone, literally. I leave. I've timed it. Kid you not.
Yes. Well, and that's how your brain, and specifically your limbic system, codes safety. Two things that the part of the brain that has control precedence is referred to as the limbic system. It's the epicenter of fight, flight, or freeze, as well as emotion and emotional processing. For some people, and for introverts, being with strangers, people where you can't predict what they're going to do next, the experience feels inconsistent, and we feel uncomfortable. And I'm an introvert as well, and yet I can't perform successfully just by working by myself. And so, it does take
I agree.
A lot of metabolic energy to move into the crowd, if you will. There's a difference. So even introverts as well as extroverts need to be a part of something. Usually, though, introverts simply want it at arm's length and on their terms and when they want it. Nothing.
What is wrong with that, Todd? I mean, seriously.
Nothing is wrong with that. Yeah. At the core of human behavior is a hardwired need to belong, to be seen, and to be valued. And one of the ways, Denise, that you're obviously meeting that need is you've created this incredible podcast where you are creating value and sharing value that you're providing, and only you could do. If you weren't doing this, all of your listeners wouldn't have access to this information that they've been getting now. So you're delivering value, but you're doing it in the way that feels safe to your system, to your brain. But you're connecting with a lot of people just in a way where it's not direct, not in the same room with them.
Exactly. So let's kind of swing this back to the office place or the factory or wherever it is that you work and play. I mean, I have been in situations where I had to work in other people's offices. You know, I was going to college at night. I was working during the day. I've never been so miserable in my life. Never have I been miserable in my life. But I learned from it. I learned that it's not really where I need to live and be. Doesn't mean that I'm antisocial. It doesn't mean that I'm shy. I really just need to be off by myself, thinking, reading, breathing, whatever it is that I'm doing. But when you take, you know, all the introversion aside, when you're talking earlier about people being in very toxic offices, what do you do? I mean, what can... we may be jumping ahead here, so, you know, kind of rein me in if you need to, but how can employers and employees say, okay, we are part of a tribe here, whether it's temporary, whether it's until retirement, whatever it is, how do we make this work? How do we make a conscious decision to be better people in the workplace?
Yeah. This started, Denise, in the early years, you know, the Industrial Revolution in America began around 1815, 1820. That's when we went from an economy where things were made by hand and at home and by a powered machine and in a factory. And ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution until just recently, there's been one constant about labor that has allowed companies not to care or need to care about the conditions that create top performance. And that is, there's always been an abundance of labor. And in an environment where there's an abundance of labor, if you're one of the people lucky enough to have a job in that environment, your top priority is to keep it. And you went in and you worked to get the money, to care for your family. And so quite literally for over 200 years, millions of Americans went to work in a toxic work environment, whether literally environmentally or emotionally or physically, or just from a boss with anger management issues, but not being led, just boring routine work. And you could do that in an environment of labor abundance because the people that couldn't hack it could just be popped out and new people popped in until you found people that could work in that environment and stick to it. And boom, there was your workforce. But what's different today is that that era of labor abundance is over and it's never coming back. We are at our lowest unemployment rate since the Vietnam War. It dropped last month to 3.8%. For the first time in our lifetimes, there are more unfilled jobs in America, 7.2 million, than there are unemployed people to fill them. So in this new environment where talent is scarce, companies have to pay more attention to what it takes for people to look forward to coming to work, because if they don't do that, the employees won't work for them. And the paradigm has flipped, Denise. Just even 5 years ago, 8 years ago, CEOs could say, these employees, they are so lucky to work for me, for my company. They are so lucky to be a part of this operation. The reality now is, the CEO says, I am so lucky these employees show up every day and work for me. I am so lucky that they're coming here instead of somewhere else. Because the fact is, in today's environment, and not all employees realize this yet, and let's hope it takes a while, but employees don't need your job. They just don't. They don't need your job because all kinds of jobs everywhere that they can go and get. So in this environment where employees have more choice than they've ever had in our lifetime, managers, who are the key pivot points on engagement, for the first time in their career, have to know how to create the conditions where their direct reports look forward to coming to work. And the fact is, most managers don't have those skills. They've never needed to have them before, and most of them don't have it today. That, again, is why 70% of Americans report being disengaged when they get to work. And the more disengaged they are, the more likely they are to jump ship.
No kidding. I mean, what's that old phrase, you know, the fish rots from the head down? It's true.
Yeah.
You know, it really is true. So basically, if I'm understanding correctly, and this is fascinating, I'm so glad you're here. It's not necessarily, I mean, employees need to be trained. They need to be motivated. They need to be incentivized. They need to, like, to show up, obviously. But it seems to me that the most training and the most engagement needs to come from the management, whether they're on the floor, whether they're in the corner office, wherever they are. They need to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but they need to be very aware of what their employees are doing, thinking, how they're interacting, and maybe not so much on the bottom line. They need to, their employees are their bottom line. So how do you help the employers?
Well, we have a three-step process because it's the most effective, and it exceeds all the other interventions that have been put forward. First, you have to measure. You can't manage what you don't measure. So you have to measure engagement. As a baseline, you measure it once, there's your baseline, and then you intervene, and then you measure again in a year and see if the interventions work, and then you measure again in the second year, and the third year, and the fourth year, and the fifth year. And So measuring is number one. Then number two, this is a challenge that many companies are measuring, but they don't do the second or the third. The second item is, once you've measured people, you then need to look at the data and identify where the biggest need is and provide that training to those managers. Don't set managers up to fail by measuring 1 year, then not doing anything to help them, and then measuring again in the second year and then complaining about how outcomes haven't shifted. They haven't shifted because you haven't invested in your leadership team. And managers, the reason they're so pivotal, 70% of the variance in how engaged an employee is, and this is to your point, Denise, 70% of the variance in how engaged an employee is directly attributable to their immediate manager or supervisor. So they do set the tone, and it's just critical that they learn how to get it right. And it's not that they're bad people. I'm not complaining about managers or saying that they don't want to do the right thing. Most of the managers we work with do want to do the right thing, but they were given a title but no portfolio of new skills. So number one, you measure. Number two, you then train your managers, give them science-based skills. And then the third thing you have to do is you have to reinforce it throughout the year. You have to give them ongoing support through the year so that they can continue to dip into this. And the way that we do that for our clients is we have created a website, managerresourcecenter.com, and all of our survey clients have free access to it. And every Tuesday, and it has all of our materials on it, all of our training materials and references to TED Talks and articles and tip sheets and self-assessments. And every Tuesday, we send every manager an email, and it's called Take 10 Tuesday. And we just want them to take 10 minutes to invest in their leadership skills, craft, and we guide them into the site where they can spend about 10 minutes just picking up a new leadership skill. And every week, this little ping is to remind them. And then we give them points when they read articles or watch a video, and so they can, little gamification, so they can start to see that, hey, they really have been investing in themselves, and then so can senior leadership. Because that way, that provides senior leadership a way to find out which managers are taking their leadership roles seriously.
That is absolutely brilliant. I wish when I had been in the workforce that this kind of information or insight had been available, because honestly, we just got up, went to work, did our best, came home, and complained to our husbands and wives about how miserable we were all day.
Yes, exactly.
The last real job I was in, I just had a flashback. I just did a whole body frisson. I literally would walk in the door on my cell phone complaining with one of my coworkers because we really hated our boss. He deserved it, just so you know. But it was just, and I remember my now former husband looking at me and saying, can we just have 5 minutes? Just five. And I went, oh,
yeah.
I was coming from such a toxic environment that I would drive home with it, complaining on the phone with it, still yakking about it when I walked in the door. And my poor husband would look at me and go, my turn. I want to complain about my day. Like, what are we doing here? And I suspect that we were not alone in that.
No, oh my gosh, no, you weren't. And this is, you've just touched on our mission and vision as employees at E3 Solutions. We know that the work we do increases retention, it increases productivity, it increases profitability, it decreases scrap and redos and drama, all of that. But the real reason that we do what we do is for what you just described. We know that if we can help employers create healthier workplaces where people thrive, and that's why I called the book Thrive by Design, if we help them design a workplace where employees will thrive, not by being told to or asked to, but because it's the conditions where the brain thrives naturally, that those employees will go home as better parents and better partners. And that's actually what we're after. We're mm-hmm. we're trying to create healthier families because we're in, you mentioned, body in free fall. Our culture, our American culture, is in free fall around connection and feeling like community. The number of Americans reporting feeling abjectly alone and isolated in their life has doubled from 20 to 40%. And this in an era when technology has made it easier to get out and to get in touch with people, it's ironic that at the same time, all of this technology has made communication almost transparent. You can communicate with anyone, anywhere in the world at any time at no cost, that we've become more isolated and alone. And one former U.S. Surgeon General calls this pandemic of isolation sweeping across America as our most severe public health threat facing the country today. And
you know, I read something about that the other day, and it startled me because we are so easily able to reach out. I mean, I have to put my phone on Do Not Disturb so nobody bugs me after 9 o'clock at night. I mean, you know, I have to take steps now to not be disturbed. My office phone goes off. My cell phone goes off. It's just, but people are reporting that they're feeling isolated, and I don't understand it. I mean, if you've got some answers for that, I would love to hear them, because I read that and went, how can this be happening?
Well,
being a committed introvert, I wouldn't understand it.
Well, what we know is that technology does not replace people in connection. So, for example, millennials tried to recreate the tribe through products like Facebook. And so they had lots of connections, lots of people. But the brain isn't feeling connected through this technology and text. And in fact, in many ways, it's made it worse. We had some young adults living with us, my wife and I, that were athletes. They were professional women soccer players. And we lived near a soccer field, a soccer complex where their team played. And we provided housing for them. And we would, this is just a small example, but we would go out to dinner with them celebrating a great game. They'd take a picture of the meal and put it on their Facebook, and then we'd have a nice meal and talk. And at the end of the meal, they'd look at the phone and they'd say, "Oh, I only got 20 likes. I'm such a loser." It actually has created this sense of I'm not like them, or I'm not getting enough likes. And then the other thing that's happening is, because of social media and just the ubiquity of it all, is that most of for young adults today, when they go on social media and they see their peers, that is people in their age group, what they're typically seeing is the 1.1% of the highest, most successful, richest people in their age group, which is a very small proportion of the population, and then they compare themselves to those people. Wow, I can't dress like that. I don't get to go to parties like that. I don't look that good when I dance. My face isn't that pretty or that handsome. And it actually has made people feel more alone and more isolated in their life as we retreat into our phones rather than talking to each other. And I see it all the time. It's terrible. And I travel every week, giving workshops and talks, and it's just now, whether it's in an elevator, everybody's on their phone. In the waiting lounge at the airport, everyone's on their phone. No one's talking. They're all deep in their phones, and we're less connected relationally with others than we ever have been. And so that sense of community has diminished, and this has real impacts. And the reason this former U.S. Surgeon General calls it a public health crisis is because what do people do when they feel abjectly alone and isolated in their life? And what has happened to the teen suicide rate over the last 3 years?
I know.
It has skyrocketed. The use of opioids and other off-label use of drugs. We hit a new record last year in the number of people dying, committing suicide, and dying from substance abuse. We have 2 million Americans in their prime work years who can't work because they're addicted. So these things happen for a reason, and this growing felt sense of being alone, people want to numb that. They're trying to numb that feeling, because this is, I don't want to get too deep into the science, but the place in the brain where we register feeling alone and isolated overlaps with the place in the brain where we feel physically at risk. So when I say we feel, in the clinical term, is emotional isolation. When we feel emotionally isolated, it's not just a vacuum; it's a danger. It's a threat that's been triggered in the brain, and we see this in couples and in the world of couples therapy, and we see it with adults of all ages and all environments.
Is this possibly what's you read a lot about workplace violence and workplace shootings, and you know that seems to be on the rise as well. Is this kind of isolation possibly contributing to these acts?
Well, I think it certainly contributes to anxiety, and so does in this world. And managers that are operating in this old school, we call it leadership 1.0, which was top-down, hierarchical, and punitive.
Right, do what I say and nobody gets hurt. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. And that kind of environment does just breed antipathy and contempt. But I think what we're, I'm not an expert in the area of workplace violence, but I think it's access to weapons that can kill people very, very quickly and in large numbers. But it also is it's a mental issue. I think we're finding that the people that are doing these things have some significant mental issues that are also at play that aren't being treated.
Oh, they would have to. You can't wake up and think that's an okay thing to do.
No, most people do not. And what we see in those people that can do those things, and is for most of us, when the place where we feel empathy in the brain also overlaps with where we feel pain, which has been an interesting understanding of empathy. So if I see you fall, for example, Denise, and you hurt your knee, my empathy, when I feel empathy for you, I actually feel a little pain in my brain as if I had fallen and hurt my knee. And so that's where part of this empathy, this reaching out, it's an understanding of the other's pain. And when this research was being done, they had one volunteer where they didn't overlap. That is, where the person felt empathy didn't even touch their pain centers. And when they went to find this person, it turned out to be a federal convict. And this just led to all kinds of understandings about serial killers and others of that ilk. They just don't feel pain for the other when they inflict it. And it's a different kind of person. And you can test for that. But most employers aren't using tests at that level to find out who they're hiring. But it might be useful going forward.
Might be. It really might be. Because when you're in a toxic environment, a work environment, sometimes you're the toxic piece. Sometimes it's somebody else and you're just kind of soaking in their garbage. And I see that a lot. It's, you know, you'll watch this group of people and there's always kind of a ringleader. And I don't play well with others. I think I mentioned that. So I'm always the one kind of standing off and observing rather than really participating. I mean, you know, I'm perfectly friendly. I'm perfectly lovely, but I don't play games. And I'll watch this one ringleader just spread garbage, and the others are just soaking it in. And I just want to walk behind them, bang their little heads together and say, wake up, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of a common problem as well. You know, you're stuck together, you're going to take on the attributes of each other.
The most frequent social recruitment tool of the disengaged and toxic is gossip. And they're often very energetic about it. And these people often are very charismatic. They attract people to them. They're very good at it. But what they spread is just sheer toxin. And you know, help us all when we find that members of the leadership team are these disengaged toxic players. And many times they are. I have managers come to me in these workshops we do around the country. And they come to me and they say, you know, this makes such total sense. And my other managers, and I usually a company's manager sit at a table and work together. And they say, can you come and talk to our CEO? Because the toxicity in our company is the CEO. It's the person running the ship. And that's just very, very challenging. And we do find that because when we measure engagement in a company, we have a 28-question online survey, a proprietary tool that we use to measure engagement, not satisfaction, but engagement. And we do it by work group. Any manager that has at least 5 people reporting to them gets their own scores. And what's a real challenge for me when I do the debrief is when the senior leadership team has scores lower than some of the other teams in the organization, because it just points directly to the CEO. Exactly. It's a very uncomfortable meeting. And then I go through the 28 questions that are rank ordered, and there's always some things that the that CEO does quite well. They got very high scores. But then you have to focus on the items at the bottom of the list, and those are the leader's opportunities. And most of them lean in. It's uncomfortable, but they realize it, and it's a moment of self-awareness, and they want to make it better because they understand they've lost a couple people from the senior leadership team, and now they're starting to understand it's them. That is, it's the CEO, not the people. And that's a revelation. And here's the other thing we found.
The very
one
important
other
word you used, though, was opportunity, and I'm glad you said that. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, well, we don't use any negative terminology in our work because the science shows that the negativity doesn't work. There's no receptor in the human brain for constructive criticism. There is for
really?
Constructive feedback. No, there isn't. Anything
I
negative
did not
is a punch to
that.
The brain. Yeah, the term is an oxymoron. And what many leaders do is they use the constructive part to justify the critical part. And I get it intellectually, but in terms of the brain and neurochemistry, it doesn't work because as soon as the limbic system triggers threat, it goes into a defensive posture, starts hijacking resources from the rest of the brain to defend, which means that the person has less IQ, less peripheral vision, they're less aware, and they're less able to participate in the conversation fully. It's kind of ironic, but it's so we're trying to show managers, for example, we have a workshop and a chapter in my book is on accountability, and it's how to hold people accountable without being negative. And when managers learn that skill, they do it more often because it's less conflictual, and they have more positive outcomes. So we just need to learn how to do it differently.
No kidding. Do you have any kind of examples you can share? Because that's a very important thing to know.
Well, sure. I'll give you one example. When we're looking at working with either a manager or a manager is working with an employee who is underperforming, one approach is to look for something that employee does at least consistently. And sometimes for these, we are able to identify A players, B players, C players, and D players in the organization. We know where they are and how many of them there are, which is really helpful. So we have a manager sitting down now with a D player, and we don't want to just fire them because the D player has a skill, and the skill's hard to replicate. Imagine if the D player is a welder. Well, you're not just going to fire them because good luck finding a welder today. So we need to work with this employee in a labor-scarce environment in a way we've never had to before. So the manager sits down, and I'm not picking on welders, by the way, but it was with a couple companies this week that are really trying to find some. I'm sitting down with that employee, and I'm going to find the thing they do well and consistently. And sometimes it's just their punctuality. They don't want to be fired for being late, so they might just show up on time every day. And so what I'm going to do is take that thing they do at least consistently, and I'm going to elevate it to a value, and then so I'll be linking this value with them, which is aspirational and positive. But then I'm going to move that value on top of something else they do where it's not expressed, and lean into that through a frame of curiosity. I know that sounds all theoretical, but here's how it goes. I'm sitting across from John Doe, my D player, and I say, John, thanks for coming in to talk to me about this today. One of the things I wanted to tell you is just how pleased I am about your punctuality. And I know that may not seem like a very big thing, but I mean, I could set my clock by the time you being here. When others are calling in because it's, you know, snow or something, you're always here. And you just show such integrity in the way that you show up on time every day. I just wish other people have that same level of integrity about when they get here to work, because it's really important for us. So I'm going to stop here and pause. I started with being punctual, and then I elevated it to be an example of integrity. That's the elevating it to a value. Now I'm going to shift the value and use it as a tool to change accountability in something else. John, I'm curious, though, all of this integrity that you've shown over the months or the years around getting here, I'm not seeing the same level of integrity in the way you clean your workstation at the end of the day, which we're all supposed to do. And I'm just curious. Help me understand why you are clearly so dedicated to one aspect that just demonstrates integrity, but on this other aspect, it just doesn't seem like it means that much to you. And I want to find out how can we work together, because I think you could be a model of how these workstations could be cleaned at the end of the day, because I've seen you do it. It's just infrequent. And when you do it, it's just outstanding. Can we work together on setting a standard for what a workstation can look like at the end of the day? I'd be really grateful if we could work together to do that so that we can show these other employees how it can be done.
So basically, instead of attacking, I think I'm following this. Here's, and look, I'm big on punctuality. If you're chronically late, I'm probably not going to deal with you very long. It's a bugaboo with me. It really is. But, you know, so basically what you've done, if I'm understanding the kind of sequence of events here, you've said, listen, punctuality is a wonderful thing, and it is. I think more employers would appreciate it if you did show up on time. But then you've engaged him in the conversation. You've engaged his thinking process rather than him thinking, oh, crap, I'm under attack. Now you've led him pretty gently down to the rest of the day, to the end of the day, and he's got time probably while you're talking to him to think about all the different things on a fast track that he does during the day and why he doesn't clean up. Maybe he's tired. Maybe he's mad. Maybe somebody ate his lunch. Who knows? But I think during that brief conversation, he had time to run down that timeline, didn't he?
He did, and absolutely. He's thinking of ways he could do it, and a couple of other things are going on here. There probably haven't been many people, especially managers, that have linked him with being a person of integrity, and that felt good. And in fact, when he heard it, little dopamine and oxytocin gets released neurochemically in the brain, and it feels good. It's an aspirational approach rather than a punitive approach. The leader 1.0 would say, John Doe, your workstation at the end of the day is a train wreck. In fact, I think you're a train wreck. Either get this right or you're out. I'm going to have to write you up. Or they'd say, you can be replaced, you know. And it's all this negative, hierarchical, top-down, punitive approach and fear-based approach to get people to comply. That just won't work going forward, because employees will just, they'll blow you off. They'll go work somewhere else because of all that negativity. It takes 5 positives to neutralize 1 negative in the brain. It takes 5 positives to neutralize 1 negative. So the more of this negative punitive approach to leadership it just doesn't work for the human brain. So what I'm doing, I've done a couple of things. I was aspirational. I said I see them as a person of integrity. Now I've asked them to demonstrate that same level of integrity over something else. And I was a little vulnerable. I asked for his help. Can we work together? Can you help me create a model for what this looks like? And vulnerability in our Western culture has been pejoratized as weakness. But it really isn't. Vulnerability in a leader is an incredible tool, because it draws normal people in to help. And so
To empathy? I mean, gotcha.
Yeah, and it's
example of
emotional intelligence.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, if you attack someone, I don't know about when you were talking about this a couple of minutes ago. You know, when you're attacked verbally or perceived physically, whatever is going to happen, I don't know about you, when you were talking about empathy, I feel it in the gut. It doesn't go to my brain. It goes to my gut. And I will instantly just kind of go, oh, and I suck in my stomach and, you know, kind of bow over a little bit, and I catch myself doing it. And I think that's probably what we all do. It's like, you just attacked me.
Yeah, you've identified the new reality and understanding of the human body and the thought process. There's a bundle of nerves that go down from the brain down and go down your back and surround your viscera called the vagus nerves. It's called polyvagal theory, and we've known that this nerve bundle goes down and surrounds the viscera since they took apart the first people. But what we didn't know until recently from a scientist by the name of Dr. Steve Porges is that the majority of information, perhaps 75-80% of the data, is going up. And so the new understanding of the brain, and this is going to feel odd to people, but when we say, hey, Denise, I want you to think about what just happened, that thinking doesn't just occur inside your cranium. The whole body thinks. The brain is just a part of the thought process, because it's getting so much information from the viscera about what's right and wrong and what feels good to do. And when you felt it in the gut, it wasn't necessarily, it may have started there and then gone up to the brain. But the viscera, and people report, for example, understanding that something bad was about to happen before they could see or sense it through the normal senses, that is hearing or sight. The whole body is a thinking instrument, and it does impact the whole body. And when people, in fact, are working in chronically negative environments, it has a physical impact on them. We know, for example, that companies that have low levels of engagement, also those employees are filing more health insurance claims. They're sicker. So this is, all these companies now that use wellness as a part of their rhetoric about what they do, and yet there's nothing you can do to improve someone's health more consistently than to change the nature of the culture. Not running clubs at lunch or gym memberships. If you want healthy employees, you need to create a healthy work environment. And by healthy, I mean an environment that we know the brain thrives in. So it doesn't have to be motivation through posters and incentives and bribes like pay for performance. We need to appeal to the intrinsic motivators that are already there and people respond to viscerally.
And see, Don, don't people already at some gut level, there's that word again, or at the back of their mind already recognize that they're being bribed? I mean, that's really what that is. It's a good thing to have these things available. I'm not arguing with it. But I also view it as like, you don't trust me to do the best on my own. So if you don't trust me to do the best, help me, and I will show up and shine. But don't bribe me.
Yeah. Not only
I'm kind
is
of a cranky
it,
person, but that's just the way I think.
Not only is the message being sent, you don't trust me to do my best, but the other part of it is you don't know what to do to help me perform at my best. And most organizations don't. And so, and it's especially, you know, it's a tactical thing to do. We need people to perform at a higher level. Okay, let's bribe them. And so you create a pay-for-performance system. The science around bribing bribing humans is really ugly about what happens. They do respond to the bribe. And many of them will do whatever it takes to achieve the bribe. But then we get outcomes like we've seen at Wells Fargo and other organizations where they set these systems up. And within months, people that are normally good, ethical people are doing things that they would have never done in other aspects of their life. Pay for performance is appealing to it's an extrinsic motivator. It's outside the self. And the extrinsic motivators are never as effective as the intrinsic motivators. And also, we now know it's really clear, money is a satisfier, it's not a motivator. That is, money does not determine people's daily behavior. And I have, you know, I'm sitting in front, yesterday I was in front of an audience of 400 people, and I could see when I said this all furrowed brows and people talking to the people next to them. And so then I said, well, let me ask this question slightly differently. If you gave every employee in your organization a 20% raise tomorrow, would you see a 20% improvement in their productivity and engagement over time? And there's a few moments of pause while they process that, and then all the heads in the room started shaking no, you wouldn't. And that's because there's no correlation between salary and benefits and daily behavior. It's not what drives what people do minute by minute. And yet that seems to be the primary tool that companies use to try to get different behaviors from people. And it's just because they don't either know the science or trust the science, or because it involves things like the role of emotion and connection. And for a lot of business leaders, that feels as intractable to them as just about anything in their life. Doesn't help that a lot of these leaders are male, and have a harder time understanding and coming alongside the role of emotion in determining what people feel. So here's what I tell them, Denise. I say, if you want to know what your culture is, what your true culture is, that is the part of your culture that impacts behavior every day, just answer this question. What does it feel like to work here? What does it feel like to work here? And the answer to that question is their true culture. That is the environment, how the environment of being in that workplace impacts the felt experience. And why is that important? Because the way people feel determines how they behave. And that is something that the workplace has never had to deal with before, because there's always been an abundance of labor. And you didn't have to care about how people felt. You gave them a task, you gave them parameters, and then they would go in and do it because they didn't want to get fired. In this environment, both in labor scarcity and with a new generation of workers, millennials, 36 of age and younger, and Gen Z, 22, 23, age and younger, they're looking for something different from work than simply a paycheck. The research says they want to extend their social network at work. They want to find meaning and purpose in their life through their work. They're much more values focused, and so they want to work for organizations that have a high sense of value in what they do. And they need to be led in a different way. And they are going to change the future of work, that is, these new generations, as well as this labor scarcity is going to force companies to reevaluate how they lead. And as I say in the TEDx talk that got a lot of pickup, the future of work will be defined more by how it feels than how it pays.
And see, I completely understand that. I mean, I lead with my gut, truly. I always have. I walk into a room, any kind of environment, and the first thing I do, truly, is send out feelers. I want to know what's going on in that room. I do engage my whole body. I've always done this. And if I feel something that is off or malignant, and you can pick it up if you're paying attention, well, I'll whip my butt around and I'm out that door. I don't stick around to be consumed by it. But if I walk into a room or a group of people and everybody is, they're feeling good, they're engaged, they're happy, I'm not feeling anything negative or untoward, I will stay and engage for 50 minutes, 3/4 minutes. But I really do think that if you will open up your senses as a person, as a boss, as an employee, just kind of open up your senses and go with your gut, I think you'd be a lot better off in the long run. What do you think? I know that's not science, but what do you think?
Well, no. I mean, we're learning that the gut is more science than we ever imagined. That old feeling, I had a gut feeling that, fill in the blank, turns out now to be literally true, that the gut is informing how we feel, and it's often more accurate than our prefrontal cortex in determining that. Absolutely. I agree with you. And it would be wonderful if we could get more companies to focus on this, which is, you know, why I wrote the book. I'm lucky that Forbes was the publisher, because it puts a nice business imprint on it. It's why I did the TEDx talk, was to try to reach a broader audience. This is something that American business needs. It will put American business in the forefront of leadership and how to do it well. These traditional models, management theories, were adequate in a labor-rich environment, but they're inadequate in a tight labor environment with a generation that's looking for something different from the workplace.
Right. Well, let's circle back to something you said about, a lot of bosses tend to be male, which I don't have any problem with at all. I mean, we're male, female, we are who we are. It's how we behave as who we are that I'm concerned with. But here's the thing. If males tend to historically be a little bit resistant to show, any kind of vulnerability or woo-woo theories like go with your gut, how do you communicate with some of these people who are very, very old school that, sometimes you have to open up and actually really listen and feel what's going on? Are they open to that? Or do they take the opportunity, I guess, is my question.
Well, yes. The answer is yes. We're finding that they do. And one of the ways we find into that, to allow that to happen, is we talk about what happens at home. Because the part of our brain that's in charge, the limbic system, it's hypervigilant for threat, but it's not very smart. It doesn't know if it's at home or at work. It doesn't know if it's a white-collar worker or a blue-collar worker. But when we talk about the impacts of these things at home, that's when they start to feel it. And that's, in the field of neuroscience, they say that until someone feels what is called limbic resonance, they're probably not going to change. And by limbic resonance, they mean you have to feel it at an emotional level. And when you feel its importance, then you're more likely to lean into it and actually do something. And this is why we always try to create an emotional connection with our audiences, because just the cognitive approach, just telling them things, insight, one is one of the things I learned 20 years ago as a consultant, insight does not automatically lead to change. It's just insight, and they may not do anything with it. So how do you get to that change part? And that's through limbic resonance. So we try to create this emotional connection. And frankly, Denise, sometimes the emotional connection is we're able to show them how much money they're losing by the low productivity of the C&D players in the organization. And when they realize that the average loss is 10 to 15% of revenue as a result of these underperforming employees, for them, that loss of money, because almost all of it, if they got it back, would go to the bottom line. That they feel limbically. So it's just finding the point that people, where that trigger gets pulled. But it's always at an emotional level. There's just too much cognitive stuff out there already. Again, we're back to the thousands of books on leadership, and yet engagement has barely budged in our country. So we clearly need to do something differently. And I'm simply suggesting, well, why don't we use science? Because it is, we now know what motivates human behavior. Why don't we just design it and design our workplaces in a way that it fits so that the brain can thrive when it's there?
See, I love that. The brain does have to thrive. I mean, you can be wandering around in a park or in the aisles at Walmart, but your brain is engaged. You're thinking ahead, you're thinking backwards, what did I forget, what's on my list? You're always thinking, you're talking to the person who's pushing the buggy next to you. We say buggy in the South, not cart, just so you know, it's a shopping cart, the buggy. And, you're always thinking. It's a buggy. But, it's just, we're always engaging our brain. And I think a lot of people just think we're walking automatically. We're not. We're thinking. I wear myself out thinking. I will literally take myself outside, step barefoot under my pecan trees. It's my kind of, sacred place, safe place, whatever you want to call it. And I dig my bare feet into the ground and I ground myself. And I will tell out loud, my neighbor can probably hear me, stop thinking. Stop thinking. Just give it a rest. But yeah. The best way to do that, just so you know, if you want to stop thinking for a moment, open your refrigerator door. You'll go blank. It's instant meditation. But, sometimes we're always thinking. So, and then that gut comes into play if you're really paying attention, which I do. And it sounds like the American workforce is starting to take a lot of notice of that, and that makes me very happy.
Yeah. Well, they are taking notice. We hit a new record last month, labor record, in the number of employees quitting, 4.8 million in 1 month. So they're voting on this with their feet. And in organizations, we have to create these conditions where people look forward to coming to work so we can retain the great people we have. And the last thing you want to have is a manager or managers inside your company that are hemorrhaging staff because people just can't work for them. We've got to stop blaming the employee, because when we look at our data, when we measure engagement, let's say you have 200 people and you measured and you discovered you had 18 of them are what we would call D players. The old method would be, well, let's go find those 18 and fire them. What I find in the data, and I say, no, don't do that, and here's why, of those 18 D players, 12 of them report to three managers. And if you fire those 12 because they're D players, we've been blaming employees for decades about their behavior, when in fact the majority of bad behavior makes perfect sense when you understand the environment that they're working in or who they're working for.
No kidding. And, the truth is we spend most of our waking life at work, wherever we are. So we really do want to be happy, engaged, alert, aware, contributing to me. I mean, I have to contribute. If I've got nothing to bring to the table, why am I here?
Exactly. Exactly. If I don't have something to contribute, I need to go find something and come back.
That's exactly right. And I think that really is the crux of the problem. Don, we've got 60 seconds, and I want you to share where people can find you on the web, tell them a little bit more about your book, if you would, and where to find that.
Sure.
And I have a copy.
Sure.
Thank you.
Oh, good. I'm glad you got it. The company website is e3solutions.com, e3solutions.com. Forbes put together a website more about the book and the TED Talk, and that's donrehm.com. donrehm.com. And then, of course, they can go to YouTube and just enter in Don Rehm TED Talk, and they'll get the access to the TED Talk. So I hope they do. I hope they lean in. I'm getting everywhere I go and speak, people are telling me how much they appreciate the book and how much of a game changer it was to see work in this new way. And I hope that people continue to do that. We could create a movement of creating just healthier workplaces where people are going home as healthier parents and healthier partners.
Exactly. And you don't have to be in a normal or traditional workplace. Listen, I've been thumbing through that book. I just got it a couple of days ago. It's on my reading list for the weekend. And there's a lot of information for solopreneurs because we are working with people. We are working. We're out there. We may not be jumping in our car and driving, but we are out there. So don't think that this book isn't for you either. It is.
Yeah. There's something in it for everyone, but truly.
Thank you,
Denise. Thank you for your contribution to creating this podcast.
Oh, this is how I get to meet people. I would not meet people like you and talk with people from all over the world in my local Walmart. Wouldn't happen. So thank you. Listen, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and the advice that you've shared with our audience, and I hope everybody who is listening will go directly to your website and go find that TED Talk. Before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcasts, and just look for your partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Don, thank you so much.
Thank you, Denise. It's been a pleasure.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.